Well, firstly, thanks for joining me on my Stray Bullets podcast. This is episode 11. It's part two of my thoughts surrounding militant Irish Republican ideology and how it evolved into such a manner that a professional IRA volunteer could happily empty a full clip of 9mm rounds into me should the opportunity arise. In this episode, I'll be concluding what I began in episode 10. So, if you haven't listened to episode 10, please check that out prior to listening to this episode. Thanks. To properly begin this episode, a brief overview of martyrdom within the psyche of militant Irish republicanism may help illuminate how some para members felt wholly justified in burning innocent people alive or scattering bomb-blasted body parts of civilians across streets. In terms of semi-automatic weapons, before a round can be chambered, the weapon's working parts need to go backwards. So let's go back. Back to the martyrdom of Thomas Ashe in 1917 and Thomas McSweeney in 1920. In 1917, Ashe, like Pierce before him, conjoined political ideology and sacrificial ideology with that of religious divinity, purity and grace. Ashe writes, "Let me carry your cross for Ireland, Lord. The hour of her trial draws near, and the pangs and pains of the sacrifice may be borne by comrades." Here we read an equivalence of burden, the sacrificial symbol of the cross, which also symbolises suffering for the betterment of others and endurance through that suffering. Ashe would align Dark Rosaline, also known as Ireland, with Christ. And those pangs and pains, the suffering of the martyr, may be transmitted down through generations to provide each with an impetus for revolution and the sacrifice made in their name. In other words, the martyrs and patriot dead of Irish republicanism would provide the mandate for the continuance of armed struggle against the British until the goals of republicanism were realised. For many republicans, the hunger strikers became, for a time, the living embodiment of the patriot dead. This was most evident during the hunger strikes of 80 and 81. Television images of almost Christ-like figures of the so-called blanket men, Irish Republican prisoners who refused to wear prison clothes and so went naked but for a blanket draped around their shoulders. Their pale complexions framed by dark falls of long hair. On the 24th of November 1980, Granada Television's World in Action was aired. It was entitled The H Block Fuse and showed footage of the blanket men stood in their cells, the walls of which they'd smeared in their own excrement. 400 prisoners were involved in what became known as the Dirty Protests. Here, presented in the television programme, were these Christ-like figures, some adorned with crucifixes or holding rosary beads, incarcerated in temples of shit. These images inevitably resounded in amongst the religious convictions of Catholic Ireland, which was itself crucified between the aggressive militancy of Irish republicanism and the memory of the colonial occupation by Britain. In quasi-religious terms, the blanket men draped themselves in the cloths of cruelty and oppression, visited upon them by the prison regime. Their gaunt images preaching the gospel of resistance from a landscape of hellish shit where the English crown had imprisoned them. That gospel, in part through World in Action's broadcast, stretching out to accepting parts of Catholic Ireland, who would soon, through the actions of the hunger strikers, become the martyrs' community, for whom the hunger strikers would embody cultural identity and expression through a form of collective suffering, but more importantly, endurance in the face of death, a symbolic death for those within the martyrs' community, caused by British arrogance and intransigence as the martyr approached death. That was how it may have been perceived among nationalism, a continuance of executions of Irish martyrs from before even those of the Easter Rising and down through the killings of Bloody Sunday and Ballymurphy, etc. That was certainly how the Provisional Army Council began to see things within the community, and they wanted to nurture and propagate such sympathies. Even despite the initial communication from Adams to the prison leadership on the 9th of April, that he didn't feel that Thatcher would allow Sands, by then a sitting member of Parliament, to die. It was on the 1st of March 1981 that Bobby Sands began his hunger strike. In ancient Ireland, hunger striking could be used, when all other means had failed, by a person who had then perceived an injustice done unto them by another. The injured party would starve themselves, a later tenet of Catholicism and being self-denial, and thus the responsibility of the hunger striker's looming death would become that of the presumed wrongdoer. While in prison, Sands wrote The Lark and The Freedom Fighter, through which he aligns himself with the lark, symbolising freedom and resistance, and how it is cruel to cage such spirit, and dismisses ordinary prisoners as selfish, slavish, submissive creatures, opposed to the unquenchable spirit of the freedom fighter. And so, I'm thinking here is someone almost forging their own mythology, both as armour and a weapon, whereby their actions upon others are not crimes, but the just punishment of those ignorant, shuffling brutes who have, and continue to, do great wrongs and cruelty against the freedom fighter in barbaric attempts to dull on his spirit and that of his nation, or as Sands refers to them, the risen people. Sands was well read. He was also a fluent Irish speaker. He also acquainted himself with revolutionary texts, such as those by Che Guevara or Franz Fanon. It's interesting to read Sands' present diaries in that he seems to momentarily escape through his dreams or imagination, and maybe even in some aspect through his poetry. It may be of some similar interest if we look at Franz Fanon. When he writes, the settler or coloniser makes history and is conscious of making it, and because he constantly refers to the history of his mother country, he clearly indicates that he himself is the extension of the mother country. Thus, the history which he writes is not the history of the country which he plunders, but the history of his own nation in regard to all that he skims off it, all that she violates and starves. The immobility to which the native is condemned can only be called in question if the native decides to put an end to that history of colonisation, the history of pillage, and to bring into existence the history of the nation, the history of decolonisation, a world divided into compartments, a motionless, manichaeistic world, a world of statues, the statue of the general who carried out the conquest, the statue of the engineer who built the bridge, a world which is sure of itself, which crosses with its stones the backs flayed by whips. This is the colonial world. The native is being hemmed in. Apartheid is simply one form of the division into compartments of the colonial world. The first thing which the native learns is to stay in his place and not to go beyond certain limits. This is why the dreams of the native are always of muscular prowess. His dreams are of action and of aggression. I dream I am jumping, swimming, running, climbing. I dream that I burst out laughing, that I span a river in one stride, or that I am followed by a flood of motor cars which never catch up with me. During the period of colonisation, the native never stops achieving his freedom from 9 in the evening until 6 in the morning. Maybe for Sands, in the context of his dreams, his writing, his imagination, freedom for him is unshackled through the untamed woodlands, the birds, which he mentions, specifically the lark, the curlew. These natural elements seem to populate his imaginary landscapes, and as such are bright with hope and meta-poetical illusions, whereas Britain, colonialism and prison are death and darkness, stretched like a black mist across Sands' landscapes, robbing it of light and its people of life. If you look at one of Sands' diary entries, which he entitled The Harvest Britain Has Sown, it's quite clear that he centres all his hatred and frustrations clearly squared in Britain. He is frustrated at his incarceration. and writes, "To accept the status of criminal would be to degrade myself and to admit that the cause I believe in and cherish is wrong. When thinking of the men and women who sacrifice life itself, my suffering seems insignificant. There have been many attempts to break my will, but each one has made me even more determined. I know my place is here with my comrades." He continues and talks of a bitterness which has grown inside me, a hatred so intensive that it frightens me. He also alludes to, "I see it also in the faces of my comrades at mass, the hatred in their eyes. One day these young men will be fathers, and these attitudes will inevitably be passed on to their children. This is the harvest Britain has sown. Her actions will eventually seal the fate of her rule in Ireland. It is frightening to see men become aged at 18 and 19, young men who were fit and strong and in body a year ago, now resemble shrunken shells of human beings. Every aspect of age block life, from cold empty cells and denial of every comfort to refusal of medical treatment, is designed to ground down our resistance, but it will not succeed. They may hold our bodies in the most inhuman conditions, but while our minds remain free, our victory is assured." So you can see almost the length of Fanon there, where Sands is basically saying they can shackle our bodies, but not our minds. And here, as with many Republicans before and after him, Sands' prose and verse places himself, and thus militant republicanism, within the bloody murk of British dungeons, dehumanised and criminalised for want of nothing more than freedom and a fair society. The bombs and bullets of the Provisional IRA are never mentioned, for they are no more than the just shouts of the wretched against the crushing heel of the foreign aggressor. Sands provides a glimpse into his Catholicism and how it informs his sense of self in the context of his actions against the state. In stanza 29 of his poem Diplock Court, he writes, "The time has come to be, to walk the lonely road like that of cavalry, and take up the cross of Irish men who've carried liberty." Diplock Court is a middle section of a trilogy Sands penned, the former being The Crime of Castlereagh, and the concluding section is entitled The Torture Mill, H Block. The trilogy, in total, reminded me of The Passion of the Christ, Castlereagh being his torture after Gethsemane. The judgment of Pilate becomes a Diplock, and the H Block his cavalry. These facets not only provide an indication of how Sands may have viewed himself and the combatants of militant republicanism, but also reinforces the connection of Christian redemptive self-sacrifice and purification to that of militant republicanism. Sands refers in his poetry to being God's friend. He sees armed resistance and offensive actions against Britain and the state of Northern Ireland not only as a right of the Irish nation, but more importantly, as a divine right. This is the theology of liberation. This time, echoing Fanon's statement about the liberating influence of violence. The violence demanded of militant republicanism is absolved. The murder of those not of the risen people is legitimised through martyrdom. A martyrdom forced on the innocent by the brutal crimes of the coloniser. As such, murder of the coloniser and his agents and those complicit becomes not only essential, but in the ideology of militant republicanism is ultimately good and just. Within republican ideology, the purity of the martyrs cannot be stained ever. Their sacrifice places them and their community above the fetid animalistic brutality and oppression of the uniforms and government of the occupier. Thus, a provisional IRA volunteer can gallantly stride up to an unarmed man holding out a white handkerchief and empty the remaining rounds of an AK-47 into that man's skull, because the volunteer, through Republican Puritanism, sees only a dehumanised occupier, a criminal, whose sentence is death. It is also why Irish Republicanism will never apologise or express any regret for the killing or mutilation of anyone who, by not supporting or being a part of the risen people, and thereby deemed complicit in aiding and abetting the maintenance and longevity of the occupier. In these terms, the blood mandate provided by the patriot dead and the martyrs, together with the sanctity of Irish soil and the endurance of her risen people through suffering and sacrifice, finds Republican theology absorbing liberation theology under the robes of a Catholic cultural identity. Thus the finger on the trigger will always have been placed there by the occupier, no matter the creed which holds the gun. Therefore the murder of the British inhuman occupier and its agents is both redemptive and just on the part of the occupied. The hunger strikers were realised in terms of their apotheosis after death, of which not only Sands's words prefigured, but even McSweeney's statement to his colleagues in Cork on the 57th day of his hunger strike held theological overtones. Here McSweeney writes, "I offer everything. Thou ask for Ireland's resurrection. It is thy will. Accept our willing sacrifice for our people. May we in dying bring glory to thy name and honour to our country that has always been faithful to thee. We rely on thy mercy to sustain us in the last moment for the constancy of our martyred people and the redemption of our country. God save Ireland, God bless, and guard the Irish Republic to live and flourish and be a model of government of truth and justice to all nations. May the liberty of the Irish people shine with thy glory, O my God, forever and ever. Amen." In addition to this is a ballad scripted by Francis P. Donnelly, a Jesuit. The ballad is entitled "He Taught Us How to Die," and it was completed prior to McSweeney's death. In flaming fight, when man his man is facing, and down the line 10,000 madly cheer, when through his veins the blood goes hotly racing, then death, forgotten, loses all its fear. But let the strife through months of anguish lengthen, and all be silence save our lonely sigh. Be with us, God, our frightened soul to strengthen. 'Twas so McSweeney taught us how to die. Oh, all too swift was Barry's sacred scaffold, and swift the guns their gifts to Plunkett sped, and hurried graves have often tyrants baffled when Ireland calls to fame her patriot dead. But here was one who clung to death's embraces, who drop by drop let all his life go by. Dark Rosaline, how queenly are thy graces, for thee he dared death's longest death to die. This is the tradition of the patriot dead, primarily those who are seen as having willingly sacrificed themselves for the greater good of their people, their risen people. They are cited in having regained their own lives and thus their dignity back from their captor at the bitter end. Thus they did not die for their crimes but for their country. Ultimately, their manner of death wholly absolved them in the eyes of the martyrs' collective community. So let's leave McSweeney and move those working parts forward again. Forward to the 13th of August 1975, when the Beardo bar on the Shankill Road was firebombed. Three men and a woman died and 44 others were injured after gunmen drove up in a car shortly before closing time and hurled a 10-pound bomb into the packed bar where customers were having a sing-song. Brendan Bick McFarland was a para member who shortly after was arrested on suspicion of having been involved in the attack on the bar. He was subsequently charged and convicted in connection with the bombing and received life sentences. In 1980, he shared a cell with Bobby Sands and Brendan Hughes and Jake Jackson. Here's what Jake Jackson says about Bick. He says, "And Bick specifically asked her," that was a lay visitor, a Baptist, "to get him a Good News Bible published by Collins. The Bibles that we had were the Revised Standard Version, the Catholic edition of the King James Bible, and Bick specifically asked for the Good News Bible because it had an updated, modernized version of the Bible in layman's language instead of stilted language. And every morning his routine was, would wake up, eat breakfast, and he'd then pull his mattress up and he'd set his runway out on the floor. Your runway is just a blanket folded and set out on the floor so you could walk up and down on it and sit back and do his daily reading of the Bible. And then he'd just sit there and I imagine he was praying. When the troubles began, Bic McFarlane was in Wales. In 1970, he left Wales and returned to the Ardoyne. Jake Jackson says that McFarlane told him, "My choices were either to come back and confront imperialism in Ireland or go to join Camilo Torres with a Breviary in one hand and an AK-47 in the other." Camilo Torres is a Colombian-born revolutionary priest, the people's priest as he was known, and one of the leading exponents of liberation theology. Torres would quote it in saying, "I took off my cassock to be more truly a priest. The duty of every Catholic is to be a revolutionary. The duty of every revolutionary is to make the revolution. The Catholic who is not a revolutionary is living in mortal sin." Torres also had another message. He says, "Change implies violence for those who retain power, but violence is not excluded from the Christian ethic. Because if Christianity is concerned with eliminating the serious evils which we suffer and with saving us from the continuous violence in which we live without possible solution, the ethic is to be violent once and for all in order to destroy the violence which the economic minorities exercise against the people." So in those terms, once you judge your enemy evil, then killing him becomes just and a divine right. Such devotion links republicanism back to the very sacrifice of Christ, through to the foundation of the Irish state after partition, in which one of the myths is centred on the very idea of heroic sacrifice. Here's Bernadette McCulloch's thoughts during an interview in 2011 when she considers Bobby Sands. She says, "Where the undercurrent of religion comes in, that God so loved the world that he sent his only son to be crucified, and so Bobby Sands so loved his country that he crucified himself, the blood sacrifice, the martyrdom. Greater love does not exist than that a man lay down his life for his friend. It is that thinking, it is that religious faith-based enormity that enables people to live with killing and being killed, because why would you not? Didn't God send his only son down here and say, 'Get yourself killed, lad, for the forgiveness of sins'? So why would people in the community whose understanding of life is around that not get themselves killed if they can justify the action within the grand scheme?" So is it that identifying yourself with Christ, with that sacrificial, heroic sacrificial figure, perceiving yourself to have a divine right, a God-given right to kill because you are on the side of good, then in those terms, can you, is it much easier for you to fully justify and live with killing and bombing? Just before I move on to consideration of the families, it may be of interest to read out a note that Bic McFarlane wrote Adams on the 22nd of July. He says, "I believe it would be wrong to capitulate. We took a decision and committed ourselves to hunger strike action. Our losses have been heavy. That I realise only too well. Yet I feel the part we have played in forwarding the liberation struggle has been great. Terrific gains have been made and the Brits are losing by the day. The sacrifice called for is an ultimate one and the men have made it heroically. Many others are, I believe, committed to hunger strike action and achieve a final settlement. I realise the stakes are very high. The Brits also know what capitulation means for them, hence their entrenched position. Anyway, the way I see it is that we are fighting a war and by choice we have placed ourselves in the front line. I still feel we should remain or maintain this position and fight on in current fashion. It is we who are on top of the situation and we who are stronger. Therefore, we maintain, I feel we must continue until we reach a settlement or where circumstances force us into a position where no choice would be left but to capitulate. I don't believe the latter would arise. I do feel we can break the Brits. What is the price to be? I think it's a matter of setting our sights firmly on target and shooting straight ahead. It's rough, brutal and ruthless, and a lot of other things as well, but we are fighting a war and we must accept that frontline troops are more susceptible to casualties than anyone. We will just have to steel ourselves to bear the worst. I will impress upon anyone who forwards his name for the hunger strike that he will only have 2 months to live. The communication ends there. It's kind of cold language, very detached. The hunger strikers themselves, of course, are not named or personalised, but just referred to as frontline troops whose sacrifice is needed, and it's just the way things are during war. As for the families of the hunger strikers themselves, this proved a bit of a thorn in the side of the Provisional Army Council, as well as a growing concern. In fact, the Provisional Army Council may have viewed them at one time as not being fully on side with the Republican strategy of the hunger strikes. Indeed, the Army Council even considered drafting a legal document to be signed by a hunger striker, which basically outlawed his family's intervention if that hunger striker went into a coma. And yet, despite all the platitudes in literature to Republican motherhood, indeed, Patrick Pearse's poem, The Mother, even in Sean O'Casey's play, Juno and the Peacock, where the mother is sort of sanctified, personified, even with Mary, Mother of Sorrows. For all that, it was men who gave the graveside orations. During the funeral of Bobby Sands, it was Owen Caron who gave one of the orations, saying that someone once said it was hard to be a hero's mother, and nobody knows better than Mrs. Sands, who watched her son being daily crucified, that word again, for 66 long days and eventually killed. Mrs. Sands epitomises the Irish mothers who in every generation watched their children go out to fight and die for freedom. And again, at the funeral of Frances Hughes, we hear Martin McGuinness pick up the oration on a similar theme, saying, "The women of Ireland can be proud of Mrs. Hughes and Mrs. Sands for the way they have borne their heavy burdens. They have shown that the women of Ireland are the backbone of our struggle for freedom." I do wonder what thoughts might have been going through the mothers' heads. I mean, listening to men giving these graveside orations, I guess they may have found some kind of comfort in seeing their sons having fully sanctified and absolved themselves on the altar of Irish republicanism, and that ideologically the murders of their sons would always and forever be that of Britain. During the 66 days that Bobby Sands was on hunger strike, 14 people were murdered. These included 3 members of the Ulster Defence Regiment, plus a retired member of the UDR, 1 member of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, along with 2 Protestant civilians. One of those civilians murdered was a young Joanne Mathers. She was a census collector who was collecting censuses in the Gobnasgale estate in Derry. She was confronted and then pursued by a masked gunman, a member of the Derry Brigade, IRA. He chased her into the house where she ran for safety, kicked the door open, and then followed her in before shooting her a number of times in the head and chest. This young woman was just another victim who died for Irish freedom. Indeed, up to the end of the hunger strikes, 64 people had been murdered. 15 members of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, 7 members of the Ulster Defence Regiment, 8 British soldiers, and 34 civilians. Indeed, just after the hunger strikes, the Catholic Church remonstrated with itself just over the immoral nature of suicide. And Bishop Cahill Daly employed what's known as the concept of moral probability, in which he says this balance rested with those who felt there was no way forward, and here he's talking about between 1916 and 1922, other than the way of violence to secure even a minimum degree of freedom for the Irish people. The campaign at that time was just. He continues on to argue that for violence to be justified, that there is no other peaceful way forward in which justice can be secured, that there is a reasonable prospect of success, that the amount of death and suffering caused by the rebellion of war does not outweigh the good which is hoped to be attained by it, and that the operations carried out or carried on in the conduct of the war are themselves in conformity with the moral law. Whoever lays down whatever that moral law is and thus defines it. So he's saying a war can be justified, yet many of the things done in its name can be quite immoral, and that he would hold, therefore, that while many of the things done by the Irish freedom fighters were immoral at the time, overall, the thrust of the war was justified. And in that latter context, of course, he's talking about the period of 1919 to 1921, but it is interesting to hear those thoughts. So, I guess in summation, it's interesting to hear the theology expressed through the patriot dead and their world image. Through sacrifice, they baptised Ireland's soil with their redemptive blood, despite the best attempts of the occupier, i.e. the British, and his agents, to crush or suppress them. Therefore, their killing of someone like me would be seen as no more than the hand of righteousness removing one more British uniform from Ireland. Forget about my Irishness, my humanity, my assumed right to life. They would say that all these things became forfeit when I made myself an active agent of the occupier. On a personal level, I've always understood the need for someone to create an ideology whereby they can dehumanise and disenfranchise their prey and thereby ease their conscience before actually killing. The theologies and beliefs that I've cited, I believe, go some way in allowing me to understand the mindset, the murder, and subsequently how the Provisional IRA has no compulsion or wish to confess to or apologise for any acts of destruction and murder ever. When you walk in the footprints of God, you have no reason to look beyond your own reflection. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of my Stray Bullets podcast. I guess it's helping me more so therapeutically, as I say, to try and understand those who wished me dead and probably would still wish me dead. Just to understand the ideology and their mindset, justification, and I guess righteousness of their convictions. Again, thank you very much for listening and continuing to listen. I really appreciate it. This concludes episode 11 of Stray Bullets. Thanks.